We have come in our studies to the section that deals primarily with the Babylonians, written in their language, the chapters 2 through 7, where he is actually dealing with the message that the Babylonians particularly need to hear in order to be able to enter into life. And the record itself, as we've said many times so far, the record is fundamentally prophetic because of the issues of the multiplicity of gods. Whenever you have more than one competitor for the title of God, then you automatically have a question as to where or how you decide which one's the real one. And of course, that's a question that most people are real reluctant to ask. Christians don't want to entertain the notion that maybe their God's not the right God. Muslims are not interested in wondering if their God's the right God. Of course, the Buddhists and all the rest of them too. And the ones that say there isn't any God certainly don't want to be told there is. It's at the very core of the human condition, because whether we actively admit it or not, even most believers, being well taught to understand that our standing before God rests in Christ, even those of us who've been taught that and understand it and to some degree believe it, are still intimidated by God. There's a certain fearsomeness about the things that are true about him, and that fearsomeness doesn't go away. I mean, there is a record here in the book of Daniel later on where Daniel is confronted by a pretty significant manifestation of the glory, and the fear just makes him pass out. And John, the gospel writer, who lived to be in his 90s when he wrote the book of the Revelation, when he saw Jesus in his ascended glory, just fainted. And these are men of God. I mean, John and Daniel were significantly well-developed believers. So it's at the root of all of our insecurities that we have our theology. And that's why we don't want to ask if our God's the right God or not. But honestly, when Daniel and his friends were taken into Babylon, they had a pretty strong case in their own faith orientation to know that Yahweh, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, was the true God. They had a long history of demonstrated reality there. And so when they went into the Babylonian Empire and went to Babylon and started to be a part of Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, they had to deal with the reality of the Babylonians' counterclaims for their gods. And that's what's really going on in this section of the book, because Daniel has already set the stage on the top of page 2 there. I said the issue of the near context is the focus on the paragraph in chapter 2, which is, as I said, written to the Babylonians in their language. The first issue of the paragraph is the impossibility of the king's demand being able to be met by anyone other than the gods. All of the four categories of the wise men that the king summoned, the conjurers, sorcerers, Chaldeans, magicians, all of these four categories of wise men who gave counsel to the king and helped to make decisions about the direction the kingdom would take and all that. He summoned those four categories of wise people, and we don't know how many there were, but the focus of their response to his requirement was, there's nobody on earth can do this. In fact, they even accused the king of being a little out of line, because they said, no king's ever asked anything like this. And Daniel includes this, and he records their constant, well, this is an impossible demand. This is an impossible demand. And he does this because the issue is, in dealing with the identity of the true God, you have to deal with what makes you think your God's the right one. And biblically, it's the one who can tell you what's going to happen in the future before it happens. So prophecy is one of the strongest arguments. And in the case of Nebuchadnezzar, he did make an impossible demand. He didn't want just any kind of interpretation given to him. So he said, you're going to have to tell me what I dreamed and what it means. And, of course, they'd been in the business long enough that if he'd have told them what he dreamed, they'd have come up with something. But Daniel set the stage in this first paragraph for prophetic revelation by making sure that his readers would know without dispute that the king had set forth a life and death requirement that only omniscience, only the omniscient one, could meet. And this was no game. These guys were going to die. As soon as they antagonized the king enough by telling him that he was out of line for his demand, he was extremely angry. Verse 12 says he became indignant and furious. And so the decree went out that the wise men should be slain. And so they started looking for Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah to kill them. So that brings us to verses 14 down through 23 that we want to look at this evening. In the opening of the reaction or the response, when they find Daniel, Daniel replies, it says, the New American Standard says, with discretion and discernment. And those kind of words, we have to wrestle with what does that mean and why did Daniel reply that way? Because he was talking to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, and Arioch had been commanded to go forth and slay the wise men of Babylon. So really, Daniel didn't have anything to lose. I mean, he was going to die. That was the whole issue. And yet, in his response, he didn't take the tact that many people, even in our cultural setting here, where Christians are pretty well noted for being outspoken and insisting on their rights and all that kind of stuff, Daniel didn't act like that. That term introduces us to this next paragraph and the focus of this next paragraph. So it begins in verse 14 with the two words that describe Daniel's reply. One of them, as I said, the New American Standard says discretion and discernment, but the King James said counsel and wisdom, and the old ASV said counsel and prudence. Well, the idea of discretion is built into the sense of the word, but typically the word is used when it's talking about somebody getting counsel or giving it. The noun here, discretion, is tied to its root word is counselor, and it's used of the men who counseled the king on the decisions that he was going to be making. So when the king wanted some input, he would ask his wise men to give him what we would call counsel or advice. And it says here that he replied with this counsel, and the implication of the word is the word itself means an ability to give solid advice, but Daniel's response to Arioch's pursuit of the command to kill the wise men implies that he had received some good advice and was taking it. Now, we don't know where that might have come from, except that Daniel has already demonstrated in chapter 1 his willingness to thoughtfully approach the problems they was facing because they were life and death. And if you have any hope of surviving, aside from the promise that God made in Habakkuk, I mean, technically, Habakkuk 2:4 stood, so Daniel could have said anything he wanted to. It wouldn't have mattered. He wasn't going to die. But there is this interplay. Even when you are confident of the promise, you still need to be wise in the way that you go about handling stuff. It's just like this weekend, one of my friends said, when it's your time to die, that's when you're going to die. And I said, yeah, and everybody believes that, looks both ways before they step out into the street. You can believe that if you want to, and the Bible does say that he's numbered our days. But that doesn't mean that you go getting careless and acting foolishly. Even the strongest fatalists, like the Muslims, they're some of the strongest fatalists on the planet. But they don't do stupid stuff in terms of their daily stuff. If they're going to cross the street, they look to see if there's a truck coming. And this whole business of when it's your turn, you're going to die. That's comforting to know, but it still you still need to be careful. And that's what Daniel's actually doing here. It's not a lack of faith on his part. It's just he apparently has gotten some good counsel for somebody, from somebody, that when you're in a bind, you need to give some thoughtful responses rather than panic-driven or angry or defensive or whatever. And so that's the word that's translated discretion. It has the idea of having received counsel and is now going to act on the advice given. But this word discernment is a very interesting word. It's called prudence. Well, it's called wisdom in the King James and prudence in the Old American Standard, and then they shifted it again and used discernment here. But none of those words really indicate what it means. Because when I look that word up, it's very rare. You don't find it hardly anywhere in the Bible. And then outside the Bible, you run into this word with a root that means the same thing as verse 13's word decree. In other words, technically, we could translate it, he replied with a willingness to accept good advice and with some respect to the decree. But the issue of the decree and how you respond to that is revealed over here in chapter 3, because when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego don't bow down and worship the image, it says in verse 10 of chapter 3, O king, you made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, so on, so on, so on, and whoever doesn't fall down and worship will be cast in the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. In verse 12, in the middle, it says, these men have disregarded you. And in his interaction with him, he reinforces in verse 15 that if they don't do it, they're going to burn. And then they still refuse. But the point there is that he's using the same term in chapter 3 that he's using a variation on here with this word discernment. And basically what it boils down to is this. Daniel gave a reply to Arioch in respect to good advice, but also with a willingness to be submissive to the decree. In other words, he didn't say, well, you can't kill me. In effect, he said, look, you give me a chance to go see the king and see if there's a way, you know, that he'll give me a little bit of time so we can come up with the answer to the issue. But when he goes in and sees the king, the whole point there is that he's going to be submissive to the decree if he doesn't come up with an answer. In other words, he's going to go to his death. And you remember what that meant. Jerked in four different pieces by the horses as they tear him limb from limb. The prospect here is really intimidating and horrible, because it's not sitting in Bible study in the 20th century in a house where nobody's around. This is a life or death deal. You're either going to come up with an answer for the king or you're going to die. So that's where he begins his presentation of this whole paragraph, verses 14 through 23, dealing with the issues of good advice and being respectful of the decree. But the issue of wisdom in this term is not the typical concept of knowing how to use knowledge to obtain the results that you're seeking, but it's related to the king's decree, the sense of yielding to the demands, and it's, as I said in chapter 3, verse 12, it's the point where Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah said, well, we can't be respectful of your decree. We're not going to do it. And of course, he gets irate at them too. But then the focus of this paragraph goes on with his response in verse 15 to Arioch. He says, for what reason is the decree from the king so urgent? And Arioch apparently likes Daniel. Apparently, these guys had a reputation among some of these people that served the king. And Arioch just told him what had happened. So Daniel went in and asked the king if he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. So he made a request to Nebuchadnezzar, will you give us 24 hours? And we'll come up with the answer to your demand. And, you know, the king has nothing to lose. Give him 24 hours. It didn't make any difference to him whether. I mean, it was the other guys that made him really angry by indicating that he was out of line by demanding this. And so he didn't have anything against Daniel or Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah particularly. They weren't even there. But from there, he goes into verse 17 and 18 And Daniel goes to his house, and he tells his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Notice he's naming them with their Jewish names. He tells them in order, according to verse 18, that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Now, I believe that Daniel understood Habakkuk 2:4. I believe that he probably even knew Habakkuk personally, because Habakkuk was a prophet in the kingdom of Judea, and Daniel was one of the royal families or one of the higher ups in the family. And it's impossible in my thinking that chapter 3 could even be written like it is if they didn't know that God had promised that they would not die. But even though he has that promise, he still has to figure out a way to meet the demand of the king. Unless, of course, it's like chapter 3, where you just can't do it, so you're going to die. And they throw them in the furnace of fire and nothing happens to them. Theoretically, I guess if they tied you to four different groups of horses and were going to pull you limb from limb, that the ropes would have turned to spaghetti or something and just melted. I mean, there's possible ways that God could have delivered them, and with God you never know, because there's just too many possibles. But anyway, he decided, Daniel did, that he and his three friends needed to ask God for the mystery. He wanted to know what this mystery was. What did he dream and what does it mean? So, in the issue of the prayer, where he is asking the God of heaven so that he might not be destroyed, there's no hesitation there in terms of unbelief. I don't think that he really is afraid of dying. I don't think that he thinks that he's going to be put to death. But he has figured that the king wants to know this. God probably gave him these dreams to interrupt his sleeping, because he wants the king to know this. And if he wants the king to know it, then who better than us to tell him? So he asked. And it's really interesting that in verses 19 and following, we have Daniel's prayers in terms of the response. It says in verse 19 that the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. And because it was, Daniel then had some things to say about God. Now, these things that he's saying about God, I think, are the core of his theology. Daniel has an attitude or a perception of God that is rooted in some pretty significant ways. And if you'll notice on the paper, A has a little asterisk beside it on the left, and D has one, and G has one. And then B and C have two little, well, those are actually exclamation marks, but they're supposed to just be long marks, because B and C go together, and then E and F go together. And the statements are like this. In A, God possesses wisdom and might. He says in verse 20, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. So he has this wisdom and might, or wisdom and power, and that's his opening statement. But notice what it says in D here under 4. It says, he gives, and this is the middle of verse 21, he gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. And the wisdom, the word wisdom, is the same one that's up here in verse 20 where he says wisdom belongs to God. So he possesses wisdom and then he gives wisdom to those who end up having it. And then in G, down at the bottom, he says, you have given, verse 23, me wisdom and power. And here again we have wisdom and might, which are the same things he had in verse 20 for God. Wisdom and might belong to God. So he's got a paragraph that looks is like this. God possesses, he gives, and he has given. And then in between, he makes a couple of statements about God in terms of the significance of what he dreamed. He changes the times and seasons. That's in verse 21. And he removes kings and sets up kings. And then in verse 22, he is the one who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what's in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. So I want us to think about this response. This is his theology. And the point in the paragraph is that if you're going to talk about who is the true God, who do we really have loyalty or should have loyalty to, and who is going to hold us accountable, the notion that men are going to be held accountable by the gods, it's all pervasive. Almost every major religion and even a lot of the minor ones have this idea that they're going to stand before God someday and give an account. And that's really what terrifies people. It says that in Hebrews 2 that Satan keeps humanity under bondage all their lifetime through the fear of death. And it's not the fear of dying. It's the fear of what comes after. Because if you could actually be firmly convinced that when you die, that's the end of you, that you cease to exist, you would have absolutely no fear of dying. What would be the point? Being afraid of... Yeah, I've said it like this before. I didn't mind not being here before I was, and I'm sure I won't mind not being here after I have been. But the whole point there is that there are lots of people who say, when you die, that's it. But you point a gun at them and all of a sudden it ain't it. Because there's got to be a reason why we're afraid. And the reason is not the dying. It's what's going to happen afterwards. There is a realization in the heart of every man that he's going to stand before the God who created him and give an answer. That's a biblical fact. The unbelievers are going to give their answers at the great white throne of judgment, and they're going to all be cast in the lake of fire, because when he evaluates them and examines them and they root all of their hope for good to come on the basis of their behavior, he's going to open the books of their behavior and he's going to go through the details of their behavior. And Jesus said, every idle word that you have spoken, you will give an account for it. Well, that's a huge burden. And there's this awareness that men have that if I die and God's not happy with me, I'm in big trouble. Well, this is what's going on here. So he asks God for the mystery so that he can have confidence as he goes before the king. So it's no surprise that he focuses on wisdom and power. But the word that's translated wisdom here is not the one that the King James used in verse 14 when it says that Daniel replied with wisdom. This word wisdom in verse 20 is the typical word for wisdom. And that means being able to take knowledge and figure out how you should act in order to obtain the result that you want. Because if you can figure out how to get the result that you want by wisdom, then you're considered to be a wise man. And you stop and think about that. We live in a cause and effect universe. And so whenever you do something, there's automatic result that happens, and then that becomes a new cause, and it creates repercussions. So if you drop the rock in the pond, the ripples just run. They just run and run and run. And you think about how in the world do we ever accomplish anything that we want to set out to accomplish, given the fact that there are 7 or 8 billion people in this world making decisions all the time with consequences that are running out, and whatever they decide may run smack up against what we decide, and their ripple may be bigger than our ripple. And so how in the world do you ever have any confidence that you're going to be able to accomplish the thing that you set out to do? I've run into that, especially with this pickup that I bought, because it has a set of plugs in it that tend to break off in the hole. It's notorious. That engine's notorious in that particular model for doing that. And I've been working on mechanical things all my life. But I was sweating when I was trying to take those plugs out, because I knew what was going to happen if one of them broke. I was going to have to tear the engine apart and get the heads off. So, you know, you wonder, now, am I going to be able to achieve this thing? And if you stop and think about it, it's a wonder that we get anything done that we really wanted to get done because of all of the complications. And that's why you're considered to be a wise man if you can use knowledge to attain your objectives. So that's the idea here. God is the one who possesses, because he's omniscient and all wise, he possesses the ability through knowledge and skillful application of knowledge to accomplish his ends. And that's part of the argument. You have run into the true God. If you can run into the God who can tell you how it's going to happen down here, regardless of all the actions that all the other people in the universe take. This is the way it's going to be. And you got to be wise to be able to figure out how it's going to be, especially if centuries go by between the time you said it's going to be this way and it is. You stop and think about Genesis 3. Jesus has promised to see the woman's going to bruise the head of the serpent. It takes 4,000 years before God sends his son into the world. And Galatians says, when the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his son. And that phrase, when the fullness of the time come, implies that for 4,000 years there have been things being put in place. And then finally, after 4,000 years of working the system, you get it to where it's now is the time for the Son to come. So he sent him. So it's a pretty strong argument that the God of the knowledge of prophecy is the God. And so he says wisdom and power belong to him. So the wisdom part's there. And then on the other hand, the word that's translated power really seems to be the equivalent to a Greek word, iskus, which means the inherent strength that's built into a thing. In the scriptures, the right arm is the strong right arm, typically. Now, I don't know what that means for all the lefties, but the typical is the strong right hand. And by the way, just for your information, you know the tribe that had all the left-handed archers? They were left-handed and they could throw a stone, not miss, left-handed. You know the tribe? Benjamin. You know what Benjamin means? Son of my right hand. So all these sons of the right hand are left-handed. But anyway, the point...
The right
hand. The correct one. Yeah. But anyway, this word power is often used because of the inherent capacities of the right hand or any other ability to do something. The inherent things are the bones and the muscles and the tendons and the ligaments and all of that. And just because you have bones set here and here and you have muscles that are attached and all the tendons, just because that's the way it is, you have a certain amount of power. Now, through exercise and a lot of other things, you can increase that. But that's the inherent capacity. It's there. And it says that God's inherent capacity belongs to God. Which means that anybody who thinks that Christianity is a crutch has never stopped to think about the fact that your lungs have an inherent capacity to inhale. And they have the ability to take that oxygen and put it in your bloodstream. But if inherent capacity belongs to God, guess what? You don't even have the ability to inhale unless he gives you that ability. I mean, it ain't a crutch. It's reality. So, the point here is that Daniel's thesis is that the two issues that are most critical for his survival and in the kingdom in Nebuchadnezzar's setting is that God possesses the wisdom and the power, the might. And he gives him that credit. He says, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever because wisdom and power belong to him. And then in developing that idea, he addresses two things. One of them is the way things change over time. It's he who changes the times and the epochs, the times and the seasons. These things are under his control, and the changes will come as he decrees them to come. And, of course, he built in certain changes that are annual. You know, summer, fall, winter, spring. Summer, fall, winter, spring. These are changes that are built into God's order. But he's the one who's behind that. But on the other hand, it says he removes kings and establishes kings. And this is particularly significant for Nebuchadnezzar. This is probably why Nebuchadnezzar's bothered. Because he's got this gut feeling that this dream has something to do with him and his ability to rule. And Daniel is point blankly giving God the credit for saying, God is the one who took down the king in Judah so Nebuchadnezzar could haul us off into captivity. But God is also the one who put Nebuchadnezzar in the kingdom of Babylon at this time. He's the one who removes kings and establishes kings, and he's the one who gives the wisdom to the wise and the knowledge to men of understanding. If he didn't give it, we wouldn't have it. So the first segment of the thing is possession, wisdom, and might, and that has to do with God changing the times and the seasons and removing kings and setting them up. But in the next verse, verse 20, it is he who reveals the profound thing. Well, in the middle of verse 21, he gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It's he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what's in the darkness and the light dwells with him. Well, here's the second salvo. God gives wisdom to the people who are wise. If they weren't wise on the basis of their own abilities, he gives wisdom. That's why they're wise. He gives knowledge. That's why they have understanding. And this wisdom is the same wisdom that he talked about in verse 20. So if a person has wisdom, it is only because God has given it to him. Whether he uses it well or not is another issue, but the fact is he wouldn't have it at all if God didn't give it to him. And this is going to be critical in the interpretation of the dream that Daniel gives to Nebuchadnezzar, because his first rattle out of the box is, I wouldn't be able to tell you this if it were just me, but there's a God in heaven, and he wants you to know. So, the revelation of the deep and secret things in verse 22, and the knowing what's in the darkness because the light dwells with him, those are the two areas of developing this issue of giving wisdom and knowledge. He gives wisdom because he reveals the profound and hidden things, and that's how things are going to work. That's what wisdom is. And he gives knowledge to men of understanding because he knows what's in the darkness and the light dwells with him. So he can tell you anything you need to know. And that brings back the promise in James 1:5. If any man lacks wisdom, let him ask. You're asking the one who's got it, and it says he'll give it without rebuke. And then at the end of the response, he says, in verse 23, to thee, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise because you have given me wisdom and power. Even now you have made known to me what we requested of you because you have made known to us the king's matter. So the focus of this paragraph is on how the God of heaven responded to Nebuchadnezzar's decree. Nebuchadnezzar says, you're going to die. The God of heaven says, no, you're not. And the reason you're not is because of who the God of heaven is and what he possesses with all this wisdom and power and all that. So that's the whole issue in the paragraph, is Daniel's focus on the God of heaven, the only God you have to worry about if you're going to worry about it. And when you're a king and you're making decrees that run contrary to the stated words that God has already given through his prophets, like Habakkuk 2:4, then you're the one that's going to lose. God isn't going to lose on this thing. So, what's the significance? Well, I think the significance of this paragraph is that Daniel builds on the prior paragraph's thesis. The readers clearly understand. He wants his readers to clearly understand that there is a God of heaven as opposed to the gods. And this God of heaven reveals his existence and knowledge by doing what no man or even any other gods can do. And he tells you what's going to happen before it happens. And there is then a serious, what I call big T theology. That's why that T has quotes on both sides. Big T theology means the way you think about God. There's a serious big T theology undergirding Daniel in his life and death situation. He's been threatened with being pulled into four different parts, limb stripped. But he's asked the king for enough time to come up with the answers, and if God doesn't give them, then, you know, he'll have to figure out another way to save them from dying. But Daniel thinks that this dream must be important to Nebuchadnezzar. So I think that's what's going on in this paragraph. In the paragraphs to come, we'll actually get into his explanation to the king, what he dreamed and what it meant.